Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VCpreneur podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Manish Singhal, founding partner at Pi Ventures, which is an early stage VC fund focused on investing in disruptive ideas leveraging machine learning, AI and IoT. Pi has already backed 13 startups from its first fund, which includes marquee names like Locus, Agnikul, SickTuple, Pixis, Visa, among others. Before founding Pi Ventures, Manish co-founded Let's Venture, a leading angel investment platform, and worked for over two decades in R&D, product, and leadership roles in companies like Motorola and Sling Media. An alum of IIT Kanpur, Manish has also contributed to the standardization of MPEG 4 standard, and holds a couple of video technology patents to his name. In this episode, Manish talks about his path to venture capital, thesis for Pi Ventures and key portfolio startups, framework for evaluating disruptive ideas, fund allocation strategy as an early stage VC, learnings from his failed attempts to raise a venture fund, role of LPs in differentiating oneself as a VC fund, and the bull case for deep tech in India. I had a lot of takeaways from this very candid chat with Manish, and I'm sure you'll enjoy this conversation too. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Manish has to share. Hey Manish, welcome to the VCpreneur podcast. Excited to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. Hi, how are you doing? And thank you for having me on your podcast.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure, Manish. So for those who don't know you yet, maybe we can start with a brief background about yourself and tell us about your path leading up to starting Pi Ventures.
Sure. So, you know, my path over last 28 years odd in the professional industry has gone through many, hitting the wall, U-turns, right turns, left turns, about turns, you know, whatever you can call it. So it all started with me passing out of IIT Kanpur back in 92. And one thing that I was very sure about is that I wanted to do something something in products, right? So want to develop an Indian product of some significance. And my definition of product was something you can hold in your hand. So that meant software only products was not going to cut it. So I ended up and landed up in Tata Elxsi, and then did a GPS written army back in those days. And then moved to Motorola, where I was working on video compression quite a bit. And as it happened, I was also in Motorola Labs in the US. And MPEG-4 was getting standardized. So I actually ended up writing a chapter in MPEG-4, which led to the commercialization of MPEG-4, which was pretty cool as a young techie. And then decided to come back to India and built a career here. So came back, joined a very exciting company called Ithium Systems. I think, therefore, I am. And it all started with me seeing a newspaper ad. It had a inspiring sort of a flag, Indian flag, and it says, we want to build the world's best DSP company. I said, okay, well, this sounds interesting. And then I kind of called the founders and had a great meeting and joined them. And then I built their whole audio-video business from scratch over 5 years. But you know what we used to do is we used to build IP and license it across the world. And our customers used to take that IP and launch product in their name with their logos. And I was like, man, you know, how it would be if our own logo was there on the product, right? And so that opportunity came with Slingbox, which eventually became a very successful product. We launched in 2005. Lets you watch your TV anywhere in the world. It was a Valley India kind of setup. And I built the entire R&D for Sling in India. And we got a pretty good exit, $380 million. So first time I experienced how equity in a startup can lead to wealth creation. And somehow our company was thinking in the right direction, and we had equity granted to almost everyone associated with the company, even in non-critical roles, so to say. So, and it was very inspiring, at least for personally for me, to see those lives changing. A young person who would probably take 10, 15 years to kind of get to a place where he has his own car or she has his own car and own house and all that, they were able to do it in 2 years, right? It was very inspiring to see. So I said, man, this is crazy, right? So this is something very interesting. Let's do more of this. And that actually, to sort of say, excited me to become a VC actually. This was back in 2009 and 10. And I called up a friend of mine who used to work with leadership recruiting. And he said, you know, I told him, boss, mereko VC banne ka hai. Kya karne ka chahiye? So he said, Manish, just get lost. You have no idea about what even a term sheet is, right? You know how to build tech. You just go and build tech. I said, okay. As it happened, I was also a student of psychology all these years, and I was actually a certified coach. So I said, okay, let me go and help some people. Or that's how it started. And I became a professional coach for a couple of years, worked with several folks. And in this whole process, a lot of startups used to come and talk to me anyway for, you know, how to build this product, how to take this to market, etc. So that natural mentoring sessions started in a way what I call as a negative business model in mentoring, right? So you actually end up giving money to the startups you like. So that's how I became an angel investor accidentally. Realized this was back in 2012, 2013, realized that a lot of stuff in India in those days were actually not right as far as angel investments go, right?
Yeah.
Very few lead investors, disproportionate term sheets. I said, this got to change, right? So luckily, crossed my path with Shanti, who's the founder of Let's Venture. We actually vibed a lot on these issues. And we said, okay, let's create something which can solve this. And that's how Let's Venture was born. So we did that for a couple of years. And actually before that, before I think Let's Venture, there was another idea that I floated. It's called the Women Entrepreneur Quest, which is WEQ. So in 2012, I paired up with another friend of mine and said, okay, let's raise a fund which can do befriending for women entrepreneurs. And two men raising that fund, right? I mean, it was a crazy idea. So we did that for 6 months, didn't find it leg. And that idea or an aspiration of becoming a VC again died there before it started. And then Let's Venture happened. And that was a very interesting experience, actually. In first 10, 15 months, we not only raised money for the platform, we got almost 700, 800 angels mobilized on the platform. We got 10, 15 deals done. We were able to standardize a term sheet and put it out there. And it laid the foundational pieces of how a platform can actually democratize and level field something which is not, right? So that was a very interesting experience. But during this thing, I also realized that maybe, you know, this is not the right fit for me because, you know, Let's Venture is a broking job, right? You're trying to make the dots connect between investors and startups. And that's not me. I would rather go and go deep into something. And at that time, I was super clear that actually next step for me is probably being a VC. And then one thing led to the other, actually. So when I was between Let's Venture and Pi, let us say, I actually tried twice more and I could not get a VC fund up. And then happened to invest in a company called Locus, which is part of our portfolio, Nishit, awesome founder. And I led their seed round and there was an AI company into logistics. And that kind of started the whole process of thinking of how AI can transform things. Landed up starting Pi in March of 2016. With a singular focus of backing disruptive AI companies. So that's how Pi started, actually. Rather, that's how my journey of various turns and about turns and U-turns finally ended up starting Pi.
Awesome. And, you know, I think that intro is definitely worth it. And thank you for being transparent about all the, you know, U-turns and about turns that you mentioned and some of the failures along the way. And we'll talk about, you know, the challenges of raising a VC fund later in our discussion. But it's fascinating to see, you know, how you've been trying and at it. You know, you have the broad vision, but there are different ways to get to it. And eventually you found the way. And you mentioned, you know, broadly AI is the theme that you wanted to go after. But if you could double click on that and tell us about the thesis when it started and how, you know, you're looking at it now, 4 years into your fund.
Sure. I think just like everything else, this has also evolved massively over the last few years. When we started the fund in 2016, we actually had some thesis, but we had obviously, I would say, no thesis also at the same time, right? What it meant is we approximately knew what we wanted to do. We basically, there was a one-line thesis. We want to back disruptive AI companies. What does that mean, right? In fact, we went around looking for them for a couple of months. We didn't find any companies. Whether this is doing worth doing the fund or not, right? But during those discussions, we found that there are enough, you know, grassroots work that is happening and just a question of time. So I think the focus was, can we find companies which are doing significant work for business problems in a disruptive way using AI and you know, obviously get in early. Over a period of time, what we have realized is now we describe our thesis actually slightly differently. We're still an AI fund and that is actually majority of the focus. But the way we describe our thesis is that we look for companies which are solving scalable global problems on a back of a significant technology disruption. We call it the 10x edge. And of course, you got to be a great team. So three pillars, right? And in addition, we say that we do not back incremental innovation. And that is a very interesting clarity which came about, I think I would say in the last 1 or 2 years, actually, in 5 year journey. Because without that clarity, we were often getting confused what actually disruptive technology means. And we would sometimes land up in the science side, or sometimes we'll land up in the incremental innovation side. And once that clarity came, then we also created this framework called the demand and supply resonance map, which we have blogged it out now. And we use that. We use that actually in all analysis of our deals. And it has given so much of clarity to the team that where we stand and how we stand it. So that is how it is now today. So if we step back and think about what technology disruptions mean here, so there are two parts of the world. One is the digital disruptions and one is the non-digital or beyond digital or physical disruptions. So in the digital part of the world, I think world is moving towards AI in a big way, because that's the best technology to create pattern-based decision-making from data, most powerful way. And it is possible that quantum may come and disrupt AI, what it does, right? And then we will look at that if that happens. In the beyond digital space, there is very interesting work happening in India. We have actually backed a company called Agnicool, which does 3D printed single piece rocket engines. I mean, it's crazy company. I mean, just think about the audacity of the idea. It just, makes me very happy and proud and scary at the same time. You know, so those kind of things. So material science, space tech, nanotech, biotech, there is some significant work happening in India. And we believe if we get our things right, if we execute right, whatever we are doing as Pi, right, we are one part in the whole process. But if we can figure this out, India can be a deep tech nation in the next 10 years. We totally believe that, and a global power in the world.
Awesome. And I think that's a good point that you mentioned, because we're still very early overall in our journey as a startup ecosystem. We are going to see the exits of the first set of startups that started in late 2000s, early 2010s. And there aren't many VC funds that understood deep tech or understood what deep tech needs. And now we are seeing that expertise and that focus on the niche, and that's supporting and encouraging a lot of founders. And that's helping them, come up with disruptive ideas that you mentioned, right? 3D printed rockets. That's a mind-blowing idea in itself.
Yeah.
And I also want to, discuss on the evaluation framework that you mentioned. So if you could, probably give an example of a startup from a portfolio, and tell us how the demand and supply resonance map that you mentioned about not incremental innovation, but disruptive innovation, how that panned out and how you evaluated that startup.
Understood. Okay. I think better done on a whiteboard, but let me try and describe it. So just imagine a 3x3 sort of a matrix with me. Mm-hmm. And on the Y side, you have what we call as a demand. And on the X side, you have something called a supply. And break this down into 3x3 sections. Right? So fundamentally, what we believe is that every startup is solving a demand and supply problem at the end of the day, right? There is no startup which exists which is not solving a demand and supply problem.
Correct.
So that actually sort of boils down to some core value, right? And then, so on the Y-axis, we have categorized demand into three buckets. The top bucket being hot, you need it now, like COVID vaccine, you need it now, right? The middle bucket, latent, Mauritius vacation, I would love to have it. But do I need to go it now? Maybe not, right? And unaware. Unaware demand is hard to express, but can you possibly print your food from a 3D printer? Just download a recipe and print your food, right? And that kind of stuff. And on the x-axis, the supply, which is sort of represented by how you can solve that demand. Could be by a simple technology, like I'm creating a website to address a need. That could be a simple technology. Or on the other side could be hard science, like 6 months back, COVID vaccine was there. And somewhere in the middle. In the middle bucket, you have a technology which is realizable, but not copyable easily, right? So that's what we call as the deep tech. So if you can imagine with me the intersection of the top bucket on the Y-axis and the middle bucket on the X-axis. So you get that zone B, we call it. That is a green zone, because where the demand is really hot, you need it. And the technology is such that it is realizable, but not copyable, right? So that, if you pick startups in that, right, you're likely to do better. Obviously, no guarantee, because market dimensions change. So this is the whole framework. And around that, then there is a concept of momentum. So what happens is nothing remains static. COVID vaccine was science 1 year back. Today, it is in production, and it is probably going towards the middle bucket. So technology always moves from right to left on the x-axis. What is hard today will become easier tomorrow, probably. Market demand is a bit crazy. It just goes up and down. What is latent today can become hot today, tomorrow. What is hot tomorrow can become latent or not exist today. So for example, I think in our blog, we've created the example of very interesting example of QWERTY keyboards. And I don't know whether you remember that BlackBerry first came out with those. And like, everybody is crazy. I want to get a hold of that QWERTY keyboard. It makes my typing so much easier. But do you have them today anymore? You don't have it because the technology has moved so much that you can actually have those boards within software. So that demand has fallen off, right? So this is the whole playground where it is. And then when you map your companies over it, it gives you a lot of clarity what you want to do with them, right? So I think a good example in our portfolio may be Wyza. So Wyza, for people who don't know, is actually a mental health conversation platform where you can chat with Wyza. It's a substitute for a human therapist. You can chat with it. It understands you. It responds back to you in a clinically safe way and leads you to therapy. Now, if you think about it, mental health, yes, it is somewhere toggling. I mean, when we invested was, I think, 2.5 years back, that time mental health was not a hot subject, but it was around the corner. People needed it somewhere. Technology-wise, it is between hard and science, right? Because it's very hard to build an AI model which can replicate a human understanding and reply to you.
Correct.
But so that's where we got in with the belief that mental health will become big later on. And the technology, they've already created a prototype. So it is in the towards the realizable side of that bucket, if you will, on the science and hard technology boundary. And now where will you plot that, right? With pandemic and a lot of other things, right? Massively it has changed. It is right in the center of that zone B almost, right? Where demand is really, really peaking on mental health. And the company is also doing well, right? So this is how we kind of use the demand and resonance map to see where the company is today and where they could be in 4 or 5 years or 2 years and what is our analysis about it. And that gives us a lot of clarity for us, at least for investment decisions.
Right. Awesome. I think that's a great explanation, especially with the example that you mentioned of QWERTY keyboards and also the challenges, you know, both for you as an investor to keep, you know, reevaluating whether you want to follow on the investment that you made initially in that startup. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But before that, you know, founders also have this challenge where they're going deep into this technology or deep into this product that they're building while the demand and supply is, you know, constantly changing and technology is changing so fast. Plus, there's this challenge of converting a technology or a project that they started into a commercial product, which is one of the biggest challenges that founders face, especially in deep tech. So what do you think should be a founder's approach, and what have you seen founders in your portfolio have done successfully to bridge that gap from a project to a commercial product?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it depends upon what you are in love with as a founder. If you're in love with the technology, you are likely to go wrong, actually. But if you are in love with what problem you want to solve and use technology as a means, you're likely to actually hone in on the right product market fit. And that is very important. And that we actually evaluate in our founders as well. We try to see what they're in love with. And let us say, so let's take some examples, right? A lot of companies we have, right? Niramai, very hard technology to build. The founder is in love with how they can solve the breast cancer problem. They're not in love with how they can be the best thermal company in the world with AI, right? And that's the difference. So when you have that sort of a focus, then all means actually go towards solving that problem. So there is another framework that we use here, Vijay. So we call it new product in an old market. So if the market is established, breast cancer screening is an established market. Everybody wants it. Everybody knows what to do. There is a commercial model in it. If I launch a new product in it, which changes the way breast cancer screening is done today, then that is likely to succeed more where the market also needs to be created, right? Sometimes we do invest in a new product, creating new markets, but then you have to allow for that evangelization effort, et cetera. But yeah, if there's a one-line answer about founders, I think founders probably need to step back and think about it. What am I in love with? And that can give a lot of clarity to them.
Right. I think that's very well put. And it sounds simple, but that's profound in many ways. And talking about, you know, the challenges that you face as an investor, and of course, as a VC, you have to think about your strategy in terms of how do you allocate your funds across different stages of those startups in pre-series, series A, and so on. So how do you look at that dynamic, you know, when you think about fund allocation, you know, across these different stages when you're investing, and what metrics, you know, influence your decision whether to follow on or, you know, not invest in further rounds?
So just like a startup plan, right? You need to have a plan, but the plan never works out. But the process of planning gives you a lot of clarity, and then plan continues to pivot and change around a little bit, right? So that's what happens for us as well. So we'll go in thinking that we will do 40% of our startups should be seed, 40% should be pre-series A, and maybe 20% should be series A, right? That's our starting plan. That's our starting plan in fund two as well. I don't know where we'll land up though. The reason it will change is that the fundamental construct is not so much about the stage, but the fundamental construct is about meeting those three pillar requirements that I just outlined in the beginning. That has to be done. Are you solving a global problem? Are you solving it much better than your peers on the back of a technology innovation? And are you a great team, right? So if that combination is hitting in, then I can't predict when I will get those combinations clicking at different stages over a life of fund. So you go and do your best as these opportunities come along, and then keep adjusting your allocation after every investment. So that's what we do. We have a plan, but it keeps changing after every investment. So follow-on decisions are actually an interesting science by itself, more than anything else, right? So I should say art. So overall, when you're getting in a company, it depends upon, you know, where you're getting in, seed to pre-series A to series A, right? So one of the ground rules we have established in our fund is we don't lead our own rounds. There is no internal rounds that we do. So if you have invested in round one, we don't lead round two ever. So someone else has to put the conviction on the team. And our decision process basically governs around how we think the company is closer to product market fit or business model fit or ready for scale or not, depending upon which stage they are in, right? So based on that assessment, essentially, we sort of decide how to do the follow-on funding.
Right. Any specific reason why you think you wouldn't lead the next round, even if you get the opportunity? Or sometimes, you know, you might have the conviction, but there aren't other VCs who have the same conviction.
Yeah. So that's an interesting question. So I think it's a harder path we have chosen. It's easier to build your own conviction in your own company, right? Because in some sense, what happens is sometimes you fall in love with your investments also, and that can screw up your objectivity about it. So therefore, an external validation is important to level set that emotion within you as an investor. Also, other thing that we try and do with our companies and our founders also, like the founders who've done well have actually done them themselves without minimal help from us, is fundamentally all these companies have a technology narrative early on. If we can convert that into a business narrative with validation, then the pool of investors that they can attract are many, because the deep techishness of the company has gone under the bonnet now, right? So to give you an example, Agnikul, which is probably the hardest tech we have done in our entire portfolio, right? Their latest round has been led by a VC, which is typically known more for, you know, consumer funding and other models rather than deep tech, right? And I was chatting with them, and, you know, what's your interest? He says, you know, we look at it as a business. We don't look at it as a deep tech company. And that is actually gives me a lot of heart. If we can convert those deep techish companies from a tech narrative to a business narrative with validation, then we don't have to worry about it, because then the whole world of VCs are available for them to pitch to.
Right. I think that totally makes sense, and, you know, gives an insight to founders as well, you know, about how they should think about follow-on rounds, or, you know, how they should be looking at in terms of progression once they have their seed round done. Manish, I want to switch gears here and talk about, you know, the challenges of raising a VC fund. There's a lot of hard work that goes in, you know, behind the scenes. You have to build a thesis, pitch to LPs, convince them, go through some regulatory and admin overhead as well, and also build a brand so that, you know, founders want to come and raise capital from you.
Sure.
And you mentioned you failed a couple of times before you started Pi Ventures. So tell us, what were the challenges, you know, that you faced when you were trying to raise your first fund?
Yeah. By the way, this is my probably fifth or sixth attempt to raise money. And so several sort of non-starters or failures before that. Different combinations went wrong. But if there is one thing I've learned there, is that just like startups need a differentiation, a USP, what are you really in for, right? It's the same thing with VCs, right? I mean, if you are launching a new fund, what is your USP? What is your belief? What is your conviction? Matters a lot to investors who want to back you. You can't just go say, you know, I'm a good guy, give me money, I'll invest in good startups, right? That doesn't work anyway, right? So it's like some founder saying, I'm doing a startup, please give me money, right? Irrespective of whatever I'm doing. That is wrong. So essentially, I think in Pi, what landed right for us is we had a sharp focus on what we want to do. that focus has become sharper over the last 4 years, and we are much more clear about what that sharp focus means for ourselves as well. But I think that is a starting point for any venture to come along, in my opinion. And then there are many other challenges, of course, right? It is still with that. I mean, that is a necessary condition, right? Not a sufficient condition to be able to do this. And then there is a lot of grind. So in fund one, I must have pitched to around 1,000 people to raise 225 crores easily. I was on a plane almost every week, traveling to different places. In fund two, we've now gone 5 months into it, right? So we started in January. Now we're in May odd. And it's to almost 400 people so far, right, in the 5 months, right? And our conversion is pretty good, right? Actually, we are converting almost 15 to 17% of all these conversations into investors. But it requires, and there are days where I have made 10 pitches with Zoom call, actually in the post-COVID world, that all these 10 meetings would have happened in probably 5 cities. Now it's Zoom call back to back, but there are days where you're having 10 calls. Yesterday I had 5 back to back calls and I was like totally exhausted at the end of it, finding the nearest bed to my table. But yeah, it's a lot of grind, a lot of work. So we are like a startup, right? I mean, if you have a brand behind you, the money raising might be different. For bigger funds, sometimes I've heard that they raise it in 2-3 weeks. But for funds like us, it is typically anywhere around a year is a good benchmark, a year, year and a half to raise your fund. Yeah,
right. I think that's really helpful. And despite your experience in technology, building the MPEG for standards, working with a couple of startups, starting Let's Venture, I'm sure you've also built a very strong network leading up to Pi. And despite that, there are so many challenges. So I think that's really helpful. Just a small follow up, if you were starting Pi all over again today, what is it that you would do differently?
It's a hard question. I think probably a couple of things, right? One is bake our thesis a bit more, go more within before you go outside. I think we were a little jumpy on going outside when we struck on the basic idea and went. We could have baked more within. And that took me actually 2-3 years to find that real thing about what is Pi about, right? It took us 2-3 years to hone on to that. If we had honed on to it before, I think we would have made probably some of the investments differently. And that is something I would encourage, right? So we take that learning to our startups now. So when startups pitch to us, and if they're early, right, we actually spend some time with them and thinking about whether this is the right thing you want to do, or is there another sort of core that you have can be applied to a different business problem. And in fact, last 6 months, I remember at least 4 companies pivoted their course completely. I mean, so completely they were making cycles before and now they're making cars, right? That kind of pivot. And I think that part is important to not rush into it, but go within deeply and find real alignment of who you are, what you bring to the table, and what you want to create as a difference in the world. I mean, it is applicable as much to us as much to any other startup in the world, because we are also a startup at the end of the day. The other thing I would do is to think about team a little bit differently as well. So I think team is a very important aspect of building any venture. And it has been very hard so far to get a team together, which we enjoy working with each other and add on to each other. And it took me almost 4.5-5 years to get to a place where I'm not losing my sleep on the team, right? So I think if there was a way to kind of do that early on in the life of the fund, that would have helped. So I think these two things probably would stand out here.
No, I think that's really helpful, and especially for those who are, now looking to start their own funds. And we are seeing a lot of, micro VC funds coming up in India as well. A lot of them have, the pedigree, but it's still, very challenging to raise that fund and to get those dollars. So I think this insight is definitely helpful. The first principles, I like the fact that, whatever you are applying to startups in terms of evaluating them, you're applying the same principles about how you want to build your own fund. So I think that's another valuable insight. The other thing I wanted to talk about is one differentiation factor as a VC fund could also be the LPs that you have, supporting you, and how you also leverage those LPs to support your startups. So if you could talk a bit about, how are you leveraging your LPs and how they have been supportive in helping you support your startups further?
Sure. I think I have to really be thankful and grateful about this. we have a very, very supportive LP base, because as a young fund, we've gone through all kinds of, you know, hardships, ups and downs, but we never heard complaint from them. We only heard encouragement from them. And that, to me, is the number one thing to kind of learn from, and also be the same for our startups. When investors start to jitter, then the founders, sometimes the confidence can jitter. So I think, to me, that is the number one thing that at a blanket level that I've learned over the last few years. From a more of a tactical perspective and a more tangible benefit perspective, we have actually, maybe I will say, four category of investors. So we have institutional players like CDC, IFC, SIDB, Axel, some of those folks who have backed us. Then we have quite a few family offices from across the world. We have HNIs who are corporate people, head of engineering in different places or head of business in different places. And we have successful entrepreneurs who have built companies and sold it, like Binny Bansal and Hitesh Oberoi, folks like those, right? So if you now take this set of people and then you look at what startups are trying to do, it's a mine of things that you can sort of work with them, right? So obviously the bigger ones help not just in follow-on funding, but opening doors wherever they can. Successful founders obviously can help our companies and grow in different ways. Family offices often need those startups for their own business needs, etc. So I think overall, these are the variety of ways. And we are still getting better at how to utilize our LP base for the need of startups. Sometimes it is not very simple to connect those dots. See, I think so far we have been fighting a battle of survival, existing, and just keeping our head above water while growing our this thing. But in the next 5 years, our journey could be more, you know, to how to do this better in all aspects. And I one of the goals we have is how we can leverage our LPs' backgrounds, experience, etc., for our startups even better than what we have done in the last 5 years.
Awesome. I think that's really helpful and gives, you know, another insight on how you should try to, you know, have a blend of different LPs to back your fund. And that can help, you know, your portfolio startups in a lot of many ways. So one last question, Manish, before we get into the rapid fire. You mentioned earlier that you are bullish about India and, you know, a lot of innovation coming out of India. What makes you so bullish about India? And, you know, why should everyone believe that we'll see a lot of deep tech innovation coming from India?
You can call me, I'm a foolish patriot, a patriotic person, but that's how I am. Do believe, always believe, right? Not today. Graduated out of IIT, I just believe that we could build the best product out of India. I always believe that. So sometimes that foolishness helps. So never thought that we couldn't do a GPS in India. Never thought that we couldn't do an MPEG-4 standard with what we know. Never thought that we could not build a sling box in India. I think somewhere, when we break away from our own perception of what the world thinks about us, you fly. To me, Indian entrepreneurs are doing that now, right? We can see a lot of companies, and you can see in our portfolio, right? Agnikul, right? 3D printed rocket engine, right? So as bold as that. Or I'll solve the mental health problem completely without any human intervention, and so on and so forth, right? There's so many of them. When you break away from a perception of what you cannot do, then you end up doing what other things you cannot do. And to me, India is somewhere there in the perception of most of the people. I think about it differently because we see those entrepreneurs working on the ground. We meet them. We are talking to them. We are meeting 8 to 10 companies with interesting innovations a week. So that's what gives me the conviction. And with our portfolio, the conviction has only grown in the last 5 years. It's not come down. And these companies are not like number 10 in the world, right? They're number one or number two in the world. Most of our companies who are cracked that problem well, right? So you can actually be a number one in the world in your space if you crack it right. And that is what, in short answer, gives me that conviction.
No, I think that's really powerful and inspiring. And like you said, you have the best vantage point to look at what's happening on ground and the kind of innovation we are seeing. And definitely, I mean, I'm with you as well on that point that we're going to see a lot of disruption and we're seeing that energy in the ecosystem overall. And it's going to show up in the kind of technology and kind of innovation that's going to come out of India in the coming years. Manish, with that, we want to quickly move into our final segment, which is the rapid fire. I'll ask some questions and hope to get your immediate thoughts on the same.
Mm-hmm. I'll try my best.
Okay, awesome. One thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the startup ecosystem today?
Get more exits going, especially for early stage investors like angels, etc. A lot of secondaries going so that the capital rotates back in a otherwise rather constipated system.
Right. And we are seeing that signs, early signs of, you know, capital recycling.
100%. 100%. It's happening at pretty good pace. I would like to 10x it.
Awesome. Perfect. Next question. The most unusual, memorable pitch meeting that you had with the founder?
Two different answers to that. Most unusual was the Agnikul pitch. And most memorable was probably Nishit's pitch when he was actually doing RideSafe just before Locals in middle of 2015. I mean, in that 120 minutes, I was convinced and became his fan. Most unusual Agnikul because, you know, it's just a very different idea. And it just kind of, over first meeting was all over above our head, but, you know, something clicked in our head and we moved forward.
Last question. VCs and founders from the ecosystem that you admire and look up to?
Quite a few, actually. You know, Subroto has been my mentor from Axel. So definitely I've learned a lot from them. I definitely respect a lot of other VCs. The Stellaris team has done a great job. Alok and Pritesh and Rahul, they're all good friends as well. So some of these folks, obviously, you know, I have a lot of respect for. Founders, our own founders, I think, in our own batch of founders, I think Srinath, I have a lot of respect for, just for the audacity of the idea. Joe, for how that mental health, which is a very difficult space, how you need to be patient as well as how you need to be a bit of a hustler as well to get this through. And I'm naming some founders, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, I'm a big fan of almost all of them in different ways. So somehow I don't connect with founders who have already become successful because, you know, obviously they are a good inspiration for the ecosystem, but you get inspired with more with people that you work with rather than you, they are very far away from me, right? I can't connect with them per se, right? On how they did, what they did. So to me, my role models are around me, not far off.
Awesome. Fantastic. Manish, this has been a very insightful, very engaging conversation. Any final thoughts for founders, current and aspiring founders who are listening to you on the podcast?
Sure. I mean, I think the only thing that works in the founder's favor is that unrelenting focus and love for what problem you want to solve. And if you have that, you will find ways and means to solve it. Sometimes the other way around becomes harder.
Fantastic. Manish, like I said, thanks again for your time. And hopefully we'll be having you back on the show sometime soon again to discuss the investments in your second fund. So thanks a lot for taking out time and for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruno podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guest know about it. Share your thoughts on social media and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.